men really want in a woman? The number one response?
Yeah.
Long eyelashes.
Shallow dogs.
All her life, Dottie Ingalls wanted to be on stage.
Let us welcome her now, Dottie Ingalls!
Any stage.
Joanne, are you married? Oh, dear, single but with married skin. We all know what married skin is, don't we?
Oh, don't we?
Thanks for coming in.
Be your agent?
Someday he's going to beg to be my agent.
Hello?
Until the day she got the break.
I have an agent.
We're all very happy for you.
That changed her life.
Who's your agent?
Arnold Moss. Arnold Moss? He eats paper.
Please stop the Dottie Ingalls!
It's going to be even better in L.A.
Arnold Moss.
L.A.?
Comics are cleaning her house.
Hand over your purse.
Stand-ups are babysitting. Even babies are babysitting.
I wanted to stay out here a little longer than I was going to.
And she's about to discover the only thing tougher than being a star.
Do you like this? People just come up to you and don't even knock?
Is being a mother.
Regular mom.
Mom was never a regular mom.
You give kids a choice. Your mother in the next room on the verge of suicide versus your mother in Hawaii in ecstasy. They choose suicide in the next room.
I'll be back in 20 years. Think of it as an adventure, girls.
Don't I ever get a turn? Isn't it ever okay for me to have a life?
I hate you.
We're going to work this out.
How?
I have no idea. From the moon.
20th Century Fox presents the directorial debut of Nora Ephron, the writer of When Harry Met Sally.
Opal, Erica, if you're watching, it's time to go to bed now.
This is my life.
Oh, hello, everyone. Welcome to the Dan Aykroyd Podcast. I'm your host, Scott White. I'm joined once again by Emmy Service. Say hello, Emmy.
Hello, Emmy.
Emmy picked our movie. We were doing This Is My Life from 1991 or 92.
Like 92, yeah, somewhere around there.
91 or 92. It stars Julie Kavner, or is it Kravner? Kavner?
I think it's Kavner.
Julie Kavner, best known as the voice of Marge Simpson, was also Brenda on the TV show Rhoda. This movie was co-written and directed by Nora Ephron, famous for her rom-coms such as Sleepless in Seattle. And Emmy made me watch this movie. She actually sent it to me.
I knew you were going to blame me. So you have the Dan Aykroyd podcast where you are covering all of Dan Aykroyd's life's work. You were going to have to do this movie eventually. But my point is, this was eventually going to come up. And so rather than you forcing someone else you know to sit through this movie, I volunteered because I actually happened to have watched this movie a bunch growing up somehow.
Well, we're just going to go through the movie.
Okay, well then let's just go through the movie. Also worth mentioning, so it stars Julie Kavner, who also had a bit part in Forget Paris. But then Samantha Mathis, who I think, if I remember correctly, also was Princess Toadstool in the acclaimed Super Mario Brothers movie.
I enjoyed Julie Kavner in Awakenings with Robert De Niro and Robin Williams. She played the nurse in that. I remember her doing a really good job in that movie.
Yeah.
And I'll go off. I have nothing against the cast and the director. It's a great cast. Nora Ephron is a very, very talented woman, or was a very talented woman.
This is not your movie. Like, I 100% go into this. I knew this was not going to be your movie.
It's not that this wasn't my movie. It's just, I didn't hate this movie. There's portions of the movie that I hated.
Sure.
I would compare this movie to comfort junk food.
Yeah.
Whereas it is by the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that's going to shock you about this movie.
I might argue on a couple scenes there. I think the thing with this movie, it's like it's such a specific topic or like genre or like niche kind of area of, there's not a, you're not like, I'm in the mood for a, you know, a comedy about like a mother daughter like duo. Like there's, and but even, but not even like a comedy comedy. It's like a drama
but
comedy.
We are but we are both in the niche of this movie. We are both comedians.
Yes, correct.
So we are in the niche.
But it's like, but it's not a, it's so, it's such a weird movie because it's not like a movie about an up and coming comedian, but it is. But it's also a movie about a, like a mother and daughter relationship, but it's like the two together. So it's like, it's a weird combination of topics. Like there are two things that you wouldn't necessarily think to go together, which is what I think makes it interesting on that level. And I, like I said, I didn't expect you to fall in love with this movie, be like a hidden treasure that I never knew about. I thought you would find it passable at best and worst, you hate it.
Oh, let's just get into it.
Okay, let's.
What is This Is My Life about?
You're
asking, tell me.
Okay, so This Is My Life is a movie about a mother and a daughter and their very particular delicate relationship, which, you know.
Two daughters.
Yes, there are two daughters, but like specifically the teenage daughter is the one that's like fraught and anxious and, you know, angsty because that's what teenagers do. So it's about twofold. Actually, it's threefold. I'd say the three like main themes. So it's the teenage daughter kind of coming into her own and figuring out like who she is as a person and her relationship with her mother, her sister. It's about the family kind of figuring out their shit without the father figure and what that means to them. And, but then also it's about Julie Kavner, the mom, who's like trying to do something for herself for once and has the opportunity to quit her day job and then move to the city and become a comedian, which is her dream. So it's like an interesting trifecta of various themes going on. So that's kind of like the gist of the movie. And then shenanigans happen along the way.
The movie opens with a voiceover.
Mm-hmm.
Really? A voiceover. So voiceover to me is one of the laziest tropes in a movie. This is my mom. She's a blah blah blah, and she thinks this movie's going to be about her, but it's not. This movie's about me. Ah, oh, shut up.
I do find it interesting that there were two, like throughout the whole movie, there's two separate voiceovers. You get the Samantha Mathis voiceover, and then you get the Julie Kavner voiceover. But it's not like you get super detailed into their brains about it. It's more of just kind of like extra exposition-y things. But I still kind of like the fact that there are two distinct points of view.
Well, we open up where she works at, Julie Kavner works at a cosmetic counter.
Yeah.
And she's there with two other women. And one of the women, I believe, was Joy Behar. And she's the funny one. She's like, you, ma'am, where do you get that skin?
She's doing like you, ma'am, customers as they walk by. Yeah.
And one of the women I believe that they do shtick with is Nora Ephron.
Ah, see, there were two people that like I thought there was one shot of someone from the back that I thought at first it was like a Julie Haggerty cameo. And I'm like, that's random. But then I don't think it was, obviously.
She goes, how old are you, hon? 35. And she goes, 32. Stay out of the sun.
Yeah,
I believe that was Nora Ephron.
Okay.
I believe that was Nora Ephron.
Okay. In my head, it was Cher, but it could be Nora Ephron.
The music was done by Carly Simon. Once again, another big name.
All of the music was Carly Simon. I found that such a, I don't know if that was a specific 90s thing to have like the soundtrack to a movie be done by a specific artist. Because I know that Harry Connick Jr. did the soundtrack for When Harry Met Sally. And I was trying to figure out or like do some half-assed internet research and see if there were other 90s movies that had a similar thing. And I couldn't find one off the top of my head. But like, I don't see that a lot now. So I don't know if that was just a very specific time frame kind of thing.
It might have been. And I know these were probably friends of Nora Ephron, and
sure.
She probably asked them to do it, and if they wanted to, they did.
The songs are also very on the nose. Like, it's the songs like
range. Hey there, single mom, with your dreams of being a stand-up comic, caught behind a counter selling makeup.
Oh, good,
that's you.
I mean, maybe not quite that on the nose, but like close enough. Yeah. And it was like mostly three songs kind of at different speeds and, you know, tempos throughout the movie. So like soundtrack is like, oh, quote unquote, soundtrack is being generous. Oh, I was going to say they're starting off like it's not Manhattan. I think it's either like Queens or Brooklyn or somewhere, wherever Ozone Park is. I know that because they mention it.
It's outside of Manhattan. Yes.
Okay.
And we're going to get to Manhattan Julie Kavner is staying with her aunt.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing her mother's sister.
That's
because it finds out that her mother is dead. Julie Kavner is divorced with two girls.
Yes.
The father is completely out of the picture.
He's gone.
This was not an anti-male movie.
No,
I was happy about that.
Yeah.
It wasn't. We had the deadbeat dad, but once again, that's just a...
It wasn't even deadbeat. Like,
we had the non-existent dad.
Yeah, just out of the picture. And it wasn't like... It was never portrayed as... he was gone and it was like a hardship, like they were struggling or they couldn't do things without him. It was never that. It was more of just the girls as young, you know, child/teenager just kind of to like emotionally grapple with what does it mean that I don't have a father figure in my life. So like, but it was
never. But I also think that I don't think he was supporting them financially either.
Oh, that I have no idea. I mean, if they did, it probably wasn't much. It was maybe like, a few hundred bucks. Like, I don't know what child support looks like. So like maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. It was negligible. It didn't affect their quality of life.
And their quality of life was, I guess, okay.
It was fine.
Four women in the house.
Yeah. Like it seemed like it was a good like two-story house, whatever. It had a small little backyard. They probably had three bedrooms, and the mom and the aunt had their separate bedrooms. The girls shared. So like it seemed like it was decent. Like they weren't like rolling in money, but they weren't wanting for anything exactly.
And the aunt is played by the actress who played George's mother on Seinfeld. And yes. I can't think of her name.
Estelle something, I think. Or is that her?
Now we come across another trope that I hate.
Okay.
Already so we're 5 minutes in and we have the voiceover trope.
Uh-huh.
And we have the deadbeat dad trope. And now we have the kids who act like adult tropes. And I hate movies where kids act like adults.
Which kid specifically?
The younger one.
Okay. Did she act like an adult? She was giving her friend a
yes.
Baby, but
they never act like children. And I know, and that just bothers me in movies.
Well, but I'll argue for this, it makes sense because throughout most of the movie, they're hanging out with adults. So I imagine that those kids don't see a lot of kids their age. Granted, when they moved, and we're getting to the part where they move, and Gabby Hoffman is saying goodbye to her few friends. But then when they get to Manhattan, they're hanging out with like practically all adults. So I would argue that part of why the younger one's always acting like an adult is because that's who she sees most of the time. But I get what you're saying.
The aunt dies, and Julie Kavner just immediately sells the house. The house was paid for. The aunt left the house to Julie. And in the will, it was like, I'm leaving you this house so you and the girls have a place to stay. And she immediately sells it. And they were toying with numbers. I don't know, around between $150,000 and $200,000 this house was worth.
1991, 1992, like that would have been a fucking fortune.
Well, they're going to need a fortune because the house immediately sells. The house sells.
It sells.
And they go to Manhattan. And the next trope is they're able to park right in front of the building where they're now staying. Do you know how hard it is to park in New York? And there's just an open parking spot right in front of the building where they're moving into.
I will forgive them that because it's the movies and we don't want to have to go through like the red tape of getting like the tow truck or the permit or what. Like, I will let that go. But I do agree that like they do the common trope of like, we move to New York and have this giant apartment for no explicable reason. But I would argue this is the first time that I've seen something where them having a giant expensive apartment makes sense given what they probably made on that house. So they probably sold that house for like between $150,000 and $200,000. Take that and buy a three bedroom apartment wherever in Manhattan. That's probably like makes sense that you were able to buy that. And whether they bought or rent, like who knows.
But do you know how much that was a huge apartment
in
downtown Manhattan?
Well, we don't know it's downtown.
That had to cost
downtown.
That had to cost a bundle.
Yes, but also keep in mind 90s prices. So it would have been expensive, but it wouldn't have been now expensive.
I'm just going to get into. So she wants to be a stand-up comedian.
Mm-hmm.
She becomes
to critique her stand-up.
Her stand-up was awful. The stand-up in the movie the stand-up clips they used in the movie were terrible. Mm-hmm. They were just terrible. But that's not the point. The point is she went from a nobody to a headlining act in Vegas, mm-hmm. television star in 6 to 8 months.
Oh, is that not realistic?
Yes, that's how it happens all the time. Comics in New York, it takes you 3 to 4 months just to get stage time.
Well, that's so weird because there's so few comedians in New York. I'm surprised.
Yes. So that's just something. It was, I mean, what I knew what was going to happen, and I was just waiting for it. All movies about stand-up comedians, for the most part, are extremely unrealistic because shit like this happens all the time.
Yeah, but would you want to watch a movie about a shitty comedian? Like, who's going to go see that one?
That would be more interesting. A shitty comedian, not. But and there's a couple of things they could have done.
Mm-hmm. Like what?
Well, she gets to New York. Mm-hmm. She's going to be the polka dot woman. So right. She wears polka dots.
Because her character's name is Dottie. The Julie Kavner is named Dottie. So she's like, I'm Dottie. I'll be with the dots. Yeah.
I'll be the dot. You know, I'll be the one they remember.
Which is fair because who will forget that many dots coming at you?
I know comics that have done that.
Yep.
I don't have a problem with that. And then she's in New York for 6 months. And it's Thanksgiving, and she has all these comedians over. You made this many friends with comics in 6 months?
That's the thing. They were already in New York. It's just they moved closer to Manhattan. So, like, I forgot to look up where Ozone Park is. So, like, it's not in Manhattan. So she probably knew some of these people already peripherally, like, on the, you know, what, the smaller club circuit. But now she's in downtown more often, and they're doing more things together, whatever.
If she was driving in from her old home to Manhattan doing comedy, but that's not set up. It's set up where she moves to Manhattan and then immediately starts doing comedy. So it's not set up that she was doing comedy before she moved to Manhattan.
Fair. I would have, sorry, I'm just adjusting my ottoman. I would assume, and this is granted, this is my assumption, but I would assume that she was doing some sort of open mic thing around Ozone Park for a while before that, just because like in the opening montage of her doing the shtick at the makeup counter, her shtick and like her presence is actually pretty good. And I would argue that she didn't just like fall into that. She probably honed that a little bit. So I would argue that she was doing open mics and stand-ups gigs at least for a little while, but you're right. They didn't like establish that she was doing that. And like Aunt Harriet was watching the kids in the meantime. But also you're skeptical at how she got so famous so fast, but given the comparison of the comedians she was hanging out with, she kind of made them all. I mean, they made her look really good. So you had baby Tim Blake Nelson doing fish couplets. And then,
that wasn't Tim Nelson. That was another one. Tim, what? You're talking about, Tim, I'm sorry. It's Tim Nelson and Bob Nelson. Uh-huh. Bob Nelson. Yeah. Uh-huh. They were both, yeah. So you're correct. Tim
Thank
Nelson.
You. Thank you. I know I was. So he's doing fish couplets. And then Kathy Najimy, who I do love, but like her, she's not even a comedian. She's like a performance artist. And then the other two women, I don't even understand exactly if they're supposed to be comedians either, but they annoyed the crap out of me. And then the other guy, that's Bob Nelson who does the impressions.
That's Bob Nelson.
He is the funniest one out of everybody. Like,
he is a legitimate stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
New York is the Mecca. Even though all those comics are shitty, like comedians like Dave Attell live in New York.
But they didn't have the dots. They didn't have Carrie Fisher as their manager.
Now, the one thing they did pull off.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that she gets a manager with me, and not just any manager,
take a breath. You're so heated.
Well, it's also the fact that it's 90 here in Houston.
Oh, God.
And I got the air off. So, yeah, I'm starting to sweat in my.
Oh, for the noise. Gotcha.
Yeah. The one thing they did pull off. So there's a couple of things.
Okay.
There's a passing line at the Thanksgiving where one of the female comics says, mm-hmm. The guy who makes the open mic lineup asked me out and I said, no, mm-hmm. Do you think that might hurt me?
Oh, yeah.
that is something legitimate that female comedians have to deal with all the time. That would have been something great to explore, where, you know, if as a female comic that she has to fight and, you know, and just press her way through the male dominated comedy. That line right there is just a legitimate line that all female comics have to deal with. Mm-hmm. And I thought that that would have been a much more interesting movie if they would have gone somewhere in that direction.
I would have watched that movie. I mean, it's a different movie, but I would have watched it. Yeah.
But the fact when Julie Kavner says, "I got an agent," and all the comics pretend to be happy, mm-hmm. but are in real life like, shit, why wasn't it me?
Oh, yeah. And Kathy Najimy, like, full on, like, pretends to stab herself in the heart, and, like, yeah. Bob Nelson just openly weeps.
They pulled that off, where comics are supportive of comics.
Yeah.
But in the back of every comic's mind, it's like, why wasn't it me?
Oh,
why wasn't it me?
I mean, that was, what the fuck was the movie called? The improv movie where Keegan-Michael.
Yes.
Yeah. Like,
I know the movie you're talking about. I can't remember
the name. It's not Don't Look Up, because that's the Netflix movie. It's like, don't something, something. But it's that. It's that same exact thing. I'm happy for you, but also, wah for me.
Well, so now we're at the comedy club.
Yo.
And with her kids, because it's perfectly acceptable to have underage children in these comedy clubs.
I had questions about that, but I mean, her set was perfectly PG-13-ish.
It's not about that. They're in a bar serving alcohol. It has nothing to do with the material.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I mean, I know this is the 90s and people were like smoking in these bars at this point still, but I don't know how strict they were back then about like letting kids in if they were like with an adult. If it's like, I'm here with my children, they're here to watch my show, they're going to sit with this other adult, you are clearly not going to serve them booze. Like, I generally don't know.
So Julie Kavner is going to the Moss. That's the big agent, the mm-hmm. Moss. The Moss is played by Dan Aykroyd, and his assistant is played by Carrie Fisher.
Carrie Fisher, who's doing the same character basically as she was in Drop Dead Fred.
And Carrie Fisher is great. She's playing this not narcissistic. When you're
neurotic,
anyway,
kind of
neurotic. Yes, she's playing this neurotic person who's smoking
constantly.
And Julie Kavner leaves the kids alone with Carrie Fisher, and nobody thinks that Dan Aykroyd is going to show up. They just think that, oh, Dan Aykroyd has sent his assistant. She'll take a look. But Dan Aykroyd shows up as the agent. I don't know what his first name was.
I can't remember.
Something Moss.
Yeah, something like Albert Moss or, you know.
Albert Moss, but he's known as the Moss.
Well, that's what the girls call him. They call him the Moss. So like, I don't think anyone else calls him that other than the girls.
And he sits down. At first, he doesn't acknowledge the children. He starts, okay, why did you bring me here?
When's our mom going to be on?
Lester's putting her on first because of you.
Well, and because of Arnold Moss.
Himself. If you have to go to the bathroom, you should do it now.
I think I know when I have to go to the bathroom, Erica.
When Mr. Therapy Forever, Mr. Legend in His Own Mind, shows up, he's always late.
I'm too young to be seeing a fat person, don't you think?
I had a dream about this enormous blimp. I mean, we are talking football field-sized blimp. And do you know who that blimp turned out to be?
Okay, real shivers for Mr. Moss from my bottle. Cut the table.
Thanks, I'll pay. So, I hope you have not dragged me here to see yet another female comedian who thinks housewives are identical to prostitutes.
No, no.
So what am I doing here?
Dottie Ingalls, remember?
Does she pretend to take a shower?
No.
Is she the one who gives birth to a mouse?
No.
Dottie Ingalls is a very funny person, and she doesn't act about our aunt. Erica helped her.
Who are these?
Our kids.
Kids?
Good evening. Welcome to another night of hilarity here. How are you?
And then he immediately starts eating a napkin.
Okay, I was waiting to get to this part. So when I was a kid and I watched, because I watched this movie a bunch as a kid and I remember enjoying it. But like when we went to watch it again now, I hadn't seen it in like 20 years. So there were some certain things in my head that were like kind of fuzzy memories, and then a lot I didn't remember. But the napkin eating, I absolutely remembered. And watching it again now, it's still such a weird, random character trait to give him. Because like, it's essentially pica, which is like when you eat random substances that are not food. And like eating papers, one of them. Another one's like when you like lick metal or eat metal or chew metal or something. But it's like a very specific character trait that he has for no reason. They never like the older daughter, Samantha Mathis, like points it out, and as him being weird and gross. But like other than that, it's just a thing he does in a few scenes for like no reason. And I always thought that was such a strange thing.
It's based on a real person. It's based on a real agent. Oh,
is it?
Okay. It is.
Okay.
But they don't explain why. And
right.
To go back, the teenage daughter, she's always chewing on her hair.
Yeah.
And they're like, don't chew on your hair. So, okay, she's chewing on her hair. He's chewing on napkins. Maybe there's going to be something. Nothing comes of any of that.
That's funny. I actually never even picked up on that correlation between her chewing her hair.
She goes up and does some of the worst stand-up I've ever seen in my life. It's just awful.
I mean, it's very hacky, I guess. Like, I've seen it's some terrible. bad stand-up, like cringy, like, oh God, I want to be anywhere but here, bad stand-up. She's not that level of, like, I just would rather, like, just melt through a hole in the floor and then have to watch this. But it's, like, it's definitely just bleh. It's bleh.
It's very hard to capture stand-up in a movie, and they don't. To me, there is nothing worse in a movie than people laughing at something that isn't funny. It just drives me crazy because it happens later.
Oh yeah, there's a bunch of stuff.
There's a bunch of stuff. This is not, this set changed her life and it was awful.
I mean, clearly the Moss didn't think so, but I don't disagree.
Clearly the Moss didn't think so. Because afterward, the Moss takes her aside.
Immediately after this, like it's the same night. It's not even time passes.
Yeah, it's immediately after a set. Boom. She's off to LA for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Do you know how long it takes to get a solid 45 minutes worth of material to headline?
I would say at least a year. At least.
At least, minimum, at least.
That's
what I meant doing it. She's been doing it at this point, three to four months.
6 months, maybe.
And he's getting her headline gigs.
Were they headlining gigs? They didn't call that specifically.
He keeps saying she's going to perform at, well, because she headlines the
Las Vegas. But that's later. So that's like, oh.
Yeah, but that's only a couple of months. I mean, that's still not.
When she's doing Vegas, we would assume it's like at least an hour's worth of material.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And okay. She's performing. They don't call it the Comedy Store. She's going to be performing at the world famous comedy place. They don't call it the Comedy Store.
But we know it's the Comedy Store.
We know it's the Comedy Store. We know that's what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And 3 weeks. So boom, she's gone for 3 weeks, which turns into 5 weeks on the road.
Yeah.
Because it's going so well out there. She is slaying with that material.
So not only are the logistics of this bananas to me, because not only do you have to like go see this person and decide immediately upon their first joke, she's the next big thing. And we have to like book her for 3 weeks, not only like her, like accommodations, travel, incidentals, all that nonsense, but like booking her for 3 weeks at the club or a few clubs, that takes time and arrangements and logistics that doesn't happen in a singular night. So that was bananas. But then also, yeah, to then to be like, oh, by the way, we're just going to keep you out. Like the incidentals of that trip must have been so much, especially in the 90s. Like, I have no idea if that was paying off for them or not at that point. Like, I have no idea how that part works, but it just seemed like the expenses they were paying for her couldn't have been less than what she was making at the studio.
This movie happened in 1991 or 92. This was after the comedy boom of the 80s.
Okay.
The mid to late 80s was the high point of stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
Where features were making $3,000 a week with airfare. It was just uncanny how much money a stand-up comic could make in the mid
to late 90s.
So it's
this is after the bottom. This is after the bottom fell out of stand-up comedy.
Oh, okay.
So somebody who's not as funny as she is would nowhere near comics. It dried up. Comedy clubs dried up. There was very little places to perform. You had to be very funny or very famous to perform. So that's another thing which, on top of everything else, doesn't make sense at this point in time. Mm-hmm. And it's 1992. So it's not like now where there's no internet, there's no YouTube, there's no TikTok where you can make a video that gets 8 million views and right. a club will say, well, I'll bring them in. They have 8 million followers. This is all before that. This is all word of mouth. This is all Johnny Carson, The Tonight Show, mm-hmm. where people see people.
And so while she's in LA doing her, you know, world famous brand new tour, the girls are being babysat throughout the month and a half by like the different comedy friends,
get a montage of comics babysitting.
Yeah. Which was like amusing ish. But I also had questions. Cause like there was a bunch of things in the beginning when before they moved to Manhattan, where Dottie's bringing the girls like on her audition with her, or when like Aunt Harriet's going to babysit them cause she's doing something else. And Erica's like, I would say 16. She seems at least 16, which seems like she's old enough to watch the younger sister while mom's at an audition or something. Like there were a bunch of times where I'm like, why do they need a babysitter? I feel like she's okay to watch the two of them for a few hours. It made sense that the mom would have the friends stay with them while she's out for a month and a half, because that's like a long period of time. But I was like, so is mom basically being like, yes, Tim Blake Nelson and Bob Nelson, stay with my daughters in the apartment by yourselves for a week while I'm gone. It's fine. That's not weird. Like they didn't show that, but they were also like, I don't know how that works. But then Bob Nelson does funny bits with like a chicken and an egg. So I guess it was okay.
So it gets to the point, we start to see she's supposed to be out there for 3 weeks. And then she calls her daughters and say, it's going so well out here that they want me to stay for another 2 weeks.
Right.
Here's another thing. New York is bigger for stand-up comedy than LA. She could have there. You know how many clubs are in New York?
I do.
She could have done this. She could have played all the big clubs in New York and flew. If she had a television spot, she could have flew out to LA, but she could have done all the clubs, which would have made more sense. Do all the clubs in New York first before you go out to LA.
I'm assuming they needed her to go to LA for the purposes of the movie. Cause her trip to LA and like her having to stay longer is kind of what starts to drive the wedge between her and her daughters and like starts to fray their relationship a little bit. So I'm guessing that's why they had to do it that way. Cause if she's in town the whole time, it doesn't have as big an effect as if she's gone for a month and a half. So I'm guessing that's why they did that, but you are also correct. The one thing to go backwards, just for like one quick little New Yorkism, I really appreciated the fact that when Dottie was about to leave to New York and the girls and her are like each schlepping a suitcase with her down the street because she's going down to the end of the street to the corner to hail the cab. That was so accurate for New York City and how you hail a cab. I was like, all right, good on you for having like a good portrayal of a New Yorkism. So that I appreciated.
So she gets back to New York and the kids. And so she's on the phone and she's like, oh, it's Newsday. They want to interview me. Really? This is another. I've got so many reallys. Really? Newsday is calling you.
Dude.
About.
My parents both worked for Newsday. And that, and like in the 90s, Newsday was like a big deal. So, and I forgot all about that part. So when she was like, oh, Newsday's on the other line, I was like, it's my mom calling to interview her. Because that was the kind of article my mom would write.
Newsday was calling Carol Burnett and asking her about female comedians. Newsday was calling Lily Tomlin. They weren't calling this woman who was doing this for less than 6 months. Not Newsday. The local paper is calling her to do this. Not Newsday.
I also fully appreciated when she came back. And she's like talking to the girls like, oh, I'm so done with LA. I'm so tired of it. I don't want to eat another Chinese chicken salad for as long as I live. And that made me laugh so hard because when I lived in LA back in the early aughts, my aunt was always eating Chinese chicken salads. That was like all she would order when we went out to food. So I thought that was really funny.
Then we have the scene with her daughter's play.
Yes. And this is another random thing that I remembered from a kid, because I remembered the weird play, but then I remembered when they go to get ice cream afterwards in my like child head, the ice cream sundae was like a giant like bucket kind of thing with like extensions coming off of it, like little spaceships. And like, I had this weird image in my head and I didn't know what it actually must have been. So finally watching this back again, and it's just like little waffle cones in the corner of like a big bowl. So I was like, oh, that's what I thought it was. So that was funny only to me.
There, and once, and here's a scene. So her little daughter is doing this scene in a play.
He has Eliot poetry like showcase. Or so. It's a very weird.
Something like that. And Julie Kavner and Carrie Fisher and the daughter are all laughing. And it's like, this is not laughing. That's not funny, whatever it is.
But it's fun. Okay, so you have to explain why that's funny. It's funny because, like, I don't know exactly what the shtick of the whole overall show was, but the Gabby Hoffman is like giant bathrobe with two other kids. So she's like on one end, and there's another kid in the middle, and then another kid on the other end. So the three of them are like shuffling out on the stage. They look like tree people, like they've got like vague tree costumes on and some makeup, and then they start reciting a poem. The poem's supposed to be recited in unison, and Gabby and the other one on the end are reciting it in unison, and the one in the middle is like a beat behind. So like the two on the end are going, "We are the Hollow Men, and we have to go," and then the one in the middle goes, "We are the Hollow Men." So it's the one in the middle is always behind, which is why it's funny, and that's why they're laughing. So they're not just being cruel.
It's why it's supposed to be funny, but it's not.
I thought it was funny in the one spot where they go, and then in the wind in the trees, and then in the wind in the tree, like that one part, I did think was funny.
But they're laughing like they're like rolling in the aisles laughing.
They're doing the chuckling behind their hands, like trying not to laugh at the children, trying their hardest, but it's like fun. They're not rolling. They're not being completely rude, but it's amusing. You would laugh if you were seeing this happen.
Probably not. Carrie Fisher says that. So now she's getting national commercials.
Right.
Yeah. Carrie Fisher's like, they want you to be the chicken lady.
Yeah.
Who is seeing her? It's like she's not auditioning for it. It's like, they want you to be the chicken lady. Where was they?
CEO at El Pollo Loco in LA. Cause like, that's the chicken.
It's not LA. So here's the thing. They shoot the commercial in New York.
Oh, that's right. They did.
Because her kids are there.
Or,
So all this going to LA to get gigs, the first gig she gets on as a commercial is shot in New York.
Do they shoot it in New York, or do they fly the girls out to LA to watch her shoot the commercial?
No, they shoot it in New York because the next scene they're back at the apartment.
Okay, fair enough.
Watching her leave for LA.
Right. Okay, you're right.
Now, here's something that's shot in my head. She goes, if I do this commercial, will I be known as, I don't know if I want to do this commercial. I might just be known as the, you know, I don't want to say the chicken lady, that's Kids in the Hall or whatever.
So, well, but this was three Kids in the Hall. So
yeah, yes. She's like, I don't want to, if I do this commercial, well, I'll be known as the chicken lady.
Yes.
And that just made me think of the woman who does Flo from Progressive.
Oh yeah. 100%. Yeah.
Because she's a comedian, but she is forever going to be known as Flo from Progressive, no matter what she does after this.
It was a Jim Varney, who is like a classically trained Shakespeare actor, but he is forever and will always be Ernest. Or Ernst. Ernest? Ernst?
Ernest.
Ernest.
Yes.
Yeah. So like, yes, that absolutely can happen if you get cast on something and get pigeonholed for the rest of your career. So that was a valid concern. But then she goes, fuck it, I'll be the chicken lady.
But she goes and does it.
Yeah.
And national commercials pay a lot of money, but the daughter goes, how long till we get rich? Oh, that commercial is going to have to play a million times for us to get rich. Well, from what I gather, a national commercial, that pays pretty good money. Miss Country Chicken, that's who.
Yes.
Now we get to, she's back in LA, and the teenage daughter.
Yeah.
Now we get the teenage love.
Now we get to the rough part.
Well, before we get to the rough part, this guy comes up and starts talking to her teenage daughter. says, I saw your mom on HBO. HBO, really? HBO? After, after, really? Newsweek and HBO. I saw your mom on HBO. She was really funny.
Yeah.
No!
Was this before or after she was? No, I think this is after she was on like a few talk shows, because she was on like Dave Letterman show, and then she was on the Not Oprah show or whatever. But then he's like, I saw her on HBO, and I think like in the 90s, you weren't getting HBO specials unless you were like Robin Williams or something.
Robin Williams and George Carlin were getting HBO specials.
Yeah, so man, she must have been really good to be getting HBO specials.
Now, there's something that we're going to have to address later.
Oh, dear.
So now we get into the subplot of the teenage daughter and this
with
kid
her
from
high
school. With
her creepy-ass boyfriend. This kid gave me such serial killer vibes, like Unabomber in training. Like, it wasn't even that he was, like, an angsty, JD from Heathers kind of thing. It was, like, his face just looks like he's about to crack in like several different ways emotionally. And I don't know what to make with it. Like every time he came on screen, I'm like, I don't want to look at your face. Your face is upsetting me.
I'm happy that they picked. So the mother actually said this to the daughter in the movie. She goes, you're not going to be a classic beauty.
Dude. Ooh. What? Yeah, that line like cuts to my core, because like I have gotten that kind of line so often when I was younger. It's like, oh, you know, you got a great face, but da da da, or like, oh, you know, there's a line from at the ballet, I think, from the musical Chorus line. It's like, you know, you'll never be beautiful, but you'll be special. It's like, special isn't great. You know, no one wants to be special. I could tell you that, if they'd rather be beautiful. So that line.
But I am glad they picked two people of attractiveness.
Yeah.
They look like normal people.
Yeah. The two teenagers are passable as teenagers, and they look like your normal teenager in the 90s would have looked. So I do also appreciate that.
It wasn't 25-year-olds playing teenagers.
Exactly. Or like, you know, Calvin Klein models playing teenagers.
It eventually leads to this awkward teenage sex scene.
Cover it. This is another scene that I remembered vaguely. And I remember vaguely, I don't want to describe this. The scene in my head that I remembered vaguely was like the POV of the kid trying to put the condom on. But like in my younger brain, I didn't realize it was a condom. So I thought it was like, I don't even know what it was. Just like a tool, but what the fuck is it called?
Cock ring?
Huh? No, not a cock ring. I wouldn't have known what that was. Like a nut kind of, like you got a nut and bolt kind of deal. Like one of the washers, like a washer or something like that. So like I had this like a warped view of what it was that he was fiddling with. But like later I got older and I was like, oh, that was 100% a condom that he was trying to put on. And yes, that scene is even more awkward than we could do justice try to explain. But I also appreciate that is like very, I didn't have sex in high school because I'm a, you know, lame, but I imagine that is a very accurate depiction of two teenagers having sex for the first time.
Except for the fact it's the classic, we're having sex in a PG movie, so she's not going to take her top off. Now, you wouldn't want a teenager to take her top off.
No, that's.
But if that was actual teenage sex, I'm sure the top would have been off. So
sure,
this is just,
we'll let that one slide again for many various reasons. But
the way he was fiddling with the condom. So I'm like, oh, so I thought, oh, he put it on wrong. She's going to end up getting pregnant. Did not happen.
They did not do that.
But I thought that was going to happen.
Yeah. No.
He broke the first one. So I thought, okay, well, the next one's going to break. His mom walks in on him.
Well, not to like go into detail, but like it's a very accurate depiction of like fiddling with the condom for way too long. She's like laying there with her arms crossed, just like, oh, fucking get this over with. He like breaks the first one, does have the decency to like go for a second one, puts it on weird, like snaps himself with. I don't know if that's a thing that guys actually do, where like they kind of snap it too tight and it like, I don't know if that's a thing.
Well, if it's done right, it should just roll right on.
Well, I mean, they're like 16 and he probably wasn't doing it right. But then it's like over in 20 seconds.
Well, okay. So I'm going to challenge you on that.
Oh boy.
Because so his mom walks in.
Yeah.
Obviously she knows what's going on, but she's playing it real cool.
Yeah.
And she's like, I'd like to talk to you two.
Mm-hmm.
And she sits them down and she pulls out this doll? Something?
It's like a diagram of a uterus, basically.
And
like
so it's a diagram of a uterus. And
it's like something you'd see in a doctor's office.
If a mother had a diagram of a uterus in her house, I think she would have told and coached her son how to put a condom on correctly.
I don't know, because they do establish earlier that the parents are endocrinologists, so the parents are doctors. So it's like plausible that that would just be something she happened to have in her office. Granted, I don't know how plausible that is, but like, I'm okay going with
that. Well, but he goes, oh God, mom, don't do this again.
Oh, that's true.
So first of all, has he had sex with other teenage girls and gotten caught? And if it's not, from what I gather, who is she showing these ovary dolls to? If it's not him. So if he's doing it again, who is she showing these to?
Well, maybe they got the diagram specifically to like have the birds and the bees talk with him and like give him very like factual scientific, here's how it is, here's the anatomy, and you do this and you do this, and that's how you do. So maybe they had the very clinical perfunctory explanation with like a laser pointer kind of deal, but they didn't have the more applicable, like, and here's how you put the damn condom on. So either way, it's very, very, but also I will also go on a limb and say that that's a really inappropriate conversation to have with someone else's kid. Like, yes, you walked in on them having sex and that's like a whole big bag of nope, but like, maybe call the mom first and be like, hey, well, so like, maybe this happened.
I'm going to, once again, I'm going to challenge you again. Because she goes, where's your mom? And she's like, instead of, my mom's not home. So she makes it sound like her mom is not around. Mm-hmm. So the doctor takes it upon herself. Well, obviously she doesn't have a mother to tell her these things. I'm going to have to tell her these things.
Yes. I do concede that point, that she does ask like, oh, where's your mom? And she's like very, she's like a little too casual. Like, oh, hey, what are you guys doing? You want some snacks? Oh, okay. It's nice to meet you. Where's your mom going? Oh, she's not out of town. All right, come in the office. And like, so like, she does get there eventually. She doesn't jump.
You know what? Let's stop talking about the teenage stuff. let's get off of that.
So. I don't know. I don't know how else to handle that situation. I still think it's kind of like one of those weird lines that maybe you don't cross when you're trying to parent someone else's kid. But again, when you're trying also to not have your son impregnate another teenager, it's kind of fair game. But you're right. Let's move on. So now.
Because we're moving on. Because you know what? She's headlining the Tropicana.
Well, that's
headlining the Tropicana.
That's the next logical step after Chicken Lady. It goes Club LA, Chicken Commercial, Las Vegas.
All under a year. This is all under a year, because every time she gets on a talk show, or every time she's would you believe that 6 months ago I was selling cosmetics? Would you believe 7 months ago I was selling cosmetics? Would you believe 8 months ago I was selling cosmetics?
I don't believe.
No. I mean, I would, but I don't believe that you're headlining the fucking Tropicana. And so they show her stand up and it's terrible.
And like at this point now, she's headlining the Tropicana. This is where she's got to have like at least an hour to 2 hours worth of material, because you don't just 20 minutes when you're headlining the Tropicana.
Now the kid, she brings the kids with her to the Tropicana.
Yeah. And Erica's,
I think she
like,
does this to impress them. Look at this hotel room. So I think she's doing it to impress her kids at this point.
Well, I think it's a little bit of like, hey, look all the cool stuff that we have and can do now. And also like a little bit to show them like, I'm doing this for a reason. I'm not just like leaving you behind. I'm trying to like build a life for us. So I get that. But it also is a little bit of like, hey, look at my cool stuff. I forget why, but Erica is like real pissed off immediately when they get to Las Vegas. And I can't remember if it's because she...
Because a woman asks her mom for a autograph.
But she was pissed before that.
No, you're right. She is pissed before that.
And I don't remember...
Because her mom...
did material about her.
That's right. That's right. They told us more about changing.
Saw it on the television. Yeah, her mom did material about her on the television.
Because the younger daughter
saw that and that got her pissed.
The younger daughter told the mom, hey, Erica wants to change her name. She wants to change her last name, meaning she's getting serious about the boy. And then the mom goes on the Not Oprah, Oprah show, tells a little anecdote about, hey, I became the chicken lady. And then a little week later, my daughter wants to change her last name. Coincidence? I don't know. She could be Flurbergsturd for all I care. And everyone's like, ha, 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 what a clever joke. And Erica's like, rage. So that's why she's pissed when she gets to Vegas. And then the women come up to her and get her autograph. And this just like fuels her fire. But then they get in the, not even a limo, it's like a town car kind of thing. And they're drinking like Pellegrino in champagne cups and, she's like, all right, fine. Yeah. So she's like, all right, I'm over it now. That's great. Let's do Vegas.
So they're in Vegas.
It's such a stupid little question, but does the Vegas airport really have slot machines in it?
Yes. Yes, okay. They do.
That was one of those things where I've never flown into Vegas, so I didn't know if that was legit or if that was just for the movie.
Totally legit.
Okay. All right.
She takes the kids around, like, this is where mom's going to be performing. And they take her up in the booth and...
Well, but first, they take her up to the giant hotel suite. The ugliest fucking hotel suite I've ever seen that has so much goddamn floral all over it. Not the flowers, because there's like flowers everywhere, but so much floral pattern everywhere in this suite. It's just so, I hate the over 90s floral motif. Like, I never liked it. And looking back at it now, I like it even less. But then they go.
Well, then they go to the, wherever she's performing in the casino. Mm-hmm. And they go up and they meet the light guy.
Right.
And this is like, so I'll be lighting your mom. Like, and the light guy has a New York Mets cap on.
Yeah. And like the lighting guy is like, not Judge Reinhold, Fast Times Ridgemont High, but like very close to that kind of vibe.
The only thing I remember from, he was one of Tommy Lee Jones's men in The Fugitive and the sequel.
Sure.
She does another hilarious show. Wow. Slaying those people in Vegas, knocking them dead with that killer material.
It was hilarious material about being in love, because being in love is like super funny.
I don't mind. It's like there's a joke. It's like there's only really four premises
right.
for any joke. Just be funny. Just be funny. I don't care if it's about airline food. If you're going to do a joke about airline food, God damn it, make it funny.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think the Vegas, of all the like bad material that she's doing, I think the Vegas routine is like the worst one. The stuff in New York, while not like good, I think is better than the stuff that she was doing in Vegas. But while she's doing her routine, the younger daughter is up in the booth with Mets guy and like clearly like has like hearts in her eyes, is full on crush on this, like, I'm assuming he's like 20 or something.
No, he's probably older than that. But there's, it's like, you don't really know this guy. You don't really know him. He's the sound guy or he's the lighting guy.
Yeah.
And you're leaving your child alone with him.
Yeah. I feel like in the 90s, the stranger danger, like the inappropriateness of that wasn't quite, they weren't as cognizant of that as we are now. Like that would never fly now. But back then, I think they were kind of like, hey, it's fine. That's just like, you know, Jimmy in the booth. It's Jimmy. Like, yeah, now it's like,
now it's Jimmy in the booth.
Jimmy in the booth. Oh, no, Jimmy in the booth.
So they're back in the hotel room and the daughters are talking and they're sharing the same bed. All the daughters always share the same bed, no matter how many beds they have.
That's not true. When they were in the first apartment,
they have their own room.
Yeah. Well, in the first apartment at Aunt Harriet's, there was like a tiny nightstand between them, but they had their own like tiny little twin bed.
And mom's having sex in the other room.
Well, they don't hear mom have sex. But they hear mom come in. They hear like the, hush, let me see if they're sleeping. And like mom does the whole like creak open the door. And the girls are like, so much sleep in here. And then she closes the door. And then they want to like know what's going on. So they do this stupid thing that people always do in movies where it's like, I'm listening at the door. I can't hear them. Give me the glass. And then they do the glass up against the door. I don't know if that actually does anything, but it always seems stupid. So then she's like, okay, they're doing something. They're talking. Okay, they went to the bedroom. So, like, once they hear the other door close in the room, they go out to look and see what happened. I don't know what they're expecting to find, but they do find a, like, trail of clothing that goes to the mother's bedroom. And it's, like, shirt, pants, bra, and then the Mets cap. And then they, like, they sit up and they, like, hold each other, like, oh, no.
The three times I've had sex, I have never done the trail of clothes.
I might have done the trail of clothes, but, like, I don't think it was, like, that specific of a trail. It might have been, like, floomp, like, pants and, like, something over here, and then floomp, shirt and bra kind of here, and then, like, in the bed. Like, I don't, it was not, like, a item of clothing, like, breadcrumbs kind of thing. But also, I had a moment of being, like, her daughter is in the other room. Would she really just so casually throw her clothes around like that? But I could also argue that she was like, well, they're sleeping. I'll go out and pick everything up once we're done. So that I kind of went
or
back.
Or you could go to his room.
Well, but then the girls would be left by themselves. And that's just scandalous.
They've been by themselves all this time.
Yes.
It's like, what's another 12 minutes?
Right. Generous.
As you said, they find the New York Mets cat. So they think mom is having sex with the lighting guy, who is 20 years younger than she is.
At least. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would say the lighting guy is like, yeah, if he's in Vegas and he's working, he's like probably, let's say a 25 at max. And mom is like 40 something, 45 maybe. She's got like a 16-year-old. So like, somewhere around there. So like 15 to 20 years older or younger than, yeah. So there's a decent age discrepancy. So the girls are both horrified for very different reasons. Opal, the younger daughter, is like, no, but I'm in love with Jimmy from the booth. I was going to marry Jimmy. How could mom do this to me? And then, you know, the older daughter, Erica, is like, oh God, mom's a perv. That's gross and inappropriate. What are we going to do? So they're next morning at breakfast, just like don't know what to do with themselves. And they're both like in tears practically.
So the next morning at breakfast, the girls are there. Carrie Fisher is there. Dan Aykroyd is there. And Julie Kavner is there.
Yeah.
And the girls are like, how could you have sex with what's the lighting boy? And mom's like, I'm having sex with him. And they point to Dan Aykroyd.
How old would you say he was?
20-something at the most.
This is just revolting.
How do you think I feel?
Mind if we join you?
Here's your breakfast, girls.
How did you two do at the tables last night? You win a bundle?
What would you say if I told you our mother was sleeping with somebody totally inappropriate?
That's the only type I ever sleep with.
We know.
Here's your coffee.
Someone who is completely the wrong age.
We're talking parent-child here.
Good morning, everyone.
Is something happening? What's the matter, sweetie? What happened?
I was just talking with your wonderful girls here, Dottie, and I'm afraid we're going to have to tell them what's been going on. Just put everything on the table. Opal thinks you're involved with someone who's wrong for you.
Inappropriate.
Really?
Now, I have a lot of experience. That's what happens when you're as old as I am. And I happen to know that children whose parents are divorced always have a rough time with the idea that their mother is with someone new because somewhere they have this fantasy that their father is coming back.
I don't have any fantasies about my father.
I don't even remember my father. I don't even remember one single thing about my father.
Well, believe me, sweetheart, the fantasy is there.
This isn't about our father. This is about mom sleeping with someone who's young enough to be Opal's boyfriend.
I'm sleeping with him.
With the Moss? You're sleeping with the Moss?
The Moss?
What about Claudia?
What about me?
You're in love with the Moss.
What on earth gave you that idea?
You said so. You said you were hung up on some crazy fat guy who was about 20 years older than you.
I'm not 20 years older than her.
That just about describes every guy I go out with. When you're my age, honey, that's all there is.
So the younger daughter is relieved. because mom's not having sex with her boyfriend.
And they're like, but the hat, how'd you get the hat? And mom's like, the hat's for you. We gave him the hat to give to you. And then Opal's like, oh my God, it's mine. I get to keep the hat. And she's fine. She's over it immediately.
Julie Kavner is sleeping with her agent. So that would have been an issue. Is she getting these gigs because she's sleeping with him? Or is she getting these gigs on her merit?
Going back to the very first time that he goes to see her at the club when he's like, why am I here? Is she fine? And then he's watching her. He starts picking, he picks up the napkin. He's like peeling back strips and like eating it and like watching her and gets like a slow smile on his face as he's watching. So like immediately from the first time he sees her perform, you're like, oh, he's interested in her and stuff. Like you can see there's something else there. So then it kind of throws the entire career path.
So throughout the movie, she drops hints like they're going to dinner. The older girl, she's like, are you in love? And they look at each other. It's like, I don't know if we're in love. We're just fucking right now.
Yeah, they don't say no, but they don't say yes. But she gives them that like half smile of like, I mean, I'm not saying it out loud, but yeah, maybe I love you. Maybe I do love you. We haven't said it, but maybe we both know it. So like.
So the older daughter comes up with, it's like, we've got to get in touch with dad to stop her from sleeping with the Moss. Where did that come from?
I don't know. And it was very weird because it wasn't like a, we got to get dad back in the picture to get these two crazy kids back together. It was literally just to keep her away from Dan Aykroyd. But there was something else to it. I can't remember what it was. Something about like, would dad want her to like be going on and doing this and like something about like the family name or so, there's something else about it. Like, oh, I think it was like, what if they get married and then he's our new dad? Do you think our actual dad would want this man to raise us? You don't think he wants to have a say in that? So then she gets it all up in their head that like it's like a bigger deal or something. She like just goes immediately into like crisis mode. But then we're like back in New York and mom is out somewhere doing something. We don't know what. We assume it's something comedy related. And it's the two daughters with the two girlfriends, the like the curly haired blonde girl and like the other like not gothy but like artsy kind of look. The two annoying girls that like are Dottie's friends that I never liked. But they're watching Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And then Erica goes into this like.
Well, hold on.
Oh.
Before that, she gets back to New York and she hires a private detective to find her dad, because nobody knows where her dad is at.
That's right. Yes. Because, yeah. So it is established at the very beginning of the movie. Dottie says, life lesson, girls. Everyone in the world is connected to, like, is two phone calls away from anybody else in the world. You just got to know what the two phone calls are. So, like, the older daughter calls one person who then gives them the number to the private detective. And then they figure out where the father is. And he's in, like, Albany or Rochester.
He's in Albany. So now she knows where her father lives. And then we have another scene. And then we have a scene with her and her boyfriend. And her boyfriend he's speaking clearly. You know, I guess they think they're in love or he thinks he loves her. And he's like, you know, he left you and he hasn't contacted you. Why do you think if you get in contact with him? And she's like, I'm sure if he knows what the situation is, he's going to come and rescue us. The kid is like, well, what about us? I appreciate the fact that they kept, you know, so even though he got caught having sex with her, it wasn't a one-time thing with him. He didn't have sex with her and throw her aside. It's like, oh, I'm, you know, I
don't know how much we're like in a relationship.
Yeah, we're in a relationship now. I'm going to be there for you. That kind of thing. That was pretty good.
And he was being like the most logical out of all like the kids in this movie of like, why do you think that your dad wants to have anything to do with you? You know, because it's been like at least 10 years. Because Opal is, I don't know, 11 or something, 11 or 12 maybe. But the kid's actually being fairly reasonable with his questions. But it doesn't matter because Erica's like got her mind made up that she's going to do something or other.
Now she's watching Lifestyles of the Rich and the Famous with the two women and her sister. Mm-hmm. And then she goes off on this rant about her mom. And it's like, it's like she's going to walk in and catch her. And that's exactly
100%,
what happens.
100%, of course. Because like, so she, hey, that's like classic movie, you know, karma. Of course, the person that you're talking about is going to walk in on your tirade. But also, she was going on for long enough that, like, it made sense that her mom walked in eventually because she went for a while.
Here's the deal. If you're one of those two adults, okay, you know what, honey? Why don't you stop, okay? You know, you don't let her go on that long. It's like, because this person is a friend of yours, and she's like, it's like, you know what? Why don't you stop talking before you say something that you regret? That's what the adult in the room should do. Mm-hmm. But they don't. And she comes home with Dan Aykroyd, and she hears her daughter basically calling her a scumbag.
Right. Well, because it basically boils down to like, it's like the almost rich, barely famous, and never home. So she's basically going on about like how her mom's been using Dan Aykroyd to get to the top, and she's abandoned her daughters, and she's like being a fake friend, and all this like terrible, you're a terrible person, you're just only looking out for yourself. Which as one who has been a teenage girl, and being of that age at that point, I can see that perspective. And I remember being younger watching this and identifying a lot with Erica. And now as an adult and being closer in age to Dottie, I'm like, wow, no, you're kind of being a shady kid. And I identify more with Dottie. But like,
here's the thing I took away from this movie. Kids suck.
Kids suck because kids aren't emotionally mature to deal with things just in general.
Kids suck. Kids keep you from your dreams. All right, everybody. So I'm telling you, kids suck and they keep you from your dreams.
Okay.
Just remember that.
A nice wholesome.
Unless you have those dreams before you have children. If you've achieved your dreams before you have kids, it's fine. But if you're trying to get somewhere with kids, almost impossible.
The more you know.
Dottie, Julie Kavner tells the two women to leave. Mm-hmm. And her and the teenage daughter, they get into a yelling match and doors are slamming.
Yep.
And Julie Kavner goes, I have nobody to help me.
Yeah.
I've been doing this alone my entire life. I have nobody to help me.
And the younger daughter, who is like also upset and was also slamming doors, has like, because like they do this thing where the Erica like storms out, goes to her room, slams the door. Opal goes to her room, slams the door. And then Julie's like yelling at Dan Aykroyd, like, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to? And then she like storms down the hall, opens Erica's door. What am I supposed to do? So then when she goes to Erica and she's saying, I have no one to help me, Opal comes out. And then she says, she's right, Erica. She really doesn't. Sorry. So even like the 10-year-old is like, yeah, she's kind of got you there. Which I found kind of.
And I get it. Kids don't see what their parents do for them until they're older.
100%.
So the next morning she's up cooking breakfast and she goes to the bedrooms and both kids are gone. And she's not really upset about it.
Right. She's way more chill than she
should. She's way more chill that both of her kids are gone.
Yeah.
And at this point, the kids have hopped a train to Albany to go see their dad because now they know these kids are moving freely, a lot more freely than I would as a child that age. They're taking subways downtown. They're taking trains all the way to Albany.
I would be more skeptical of that. However, I was around that age, around like the mid-90s, and I was going into New York City by myself from Long Island. So I was occasionally taking the train. Like my mom or my dad would like drive me to the train station. I would take the Long Island Railroad into Penn Station and then like go do something and then come back. I was like, I forget how old I was when I did it by myself for the first time, maybe like 14, 15, which like looking back, I'm like, wow, mom and dad let me do that at 14, 15. So like part of me wants to be like, yeah, how did they not get stopped or anything wandering around by themselves? But then the other part of me that lived in reality during that time did do that. So I'm going to let that one go.
Well, they get to their dad's house His current wife opens the door.
Who I've seen her in other movies too. Like the one, what is the movie? Oh, it's some stupid House Arrest. I remember she was somebody's wife in House Arrest, which is a real bad movie with like Kevin Pollak and Jamie Lee Curtis and their kids trying to get them back together. So like she's one of those actresses that like been in things, but you like don't remember her name. She's a that girl.
Right. She's
yeah.
So the kids get to their dad's house and he immediately takes them in their arms and takes them into the family. I'm just fucking with you. That's exactly what happens is what everybody thinks what's going to happen. His dad doesn't want them there.
Well, but also, first of all, I was like, what the fuck movie were you watching? So they get there. Dad's not even there. They open the door and the new wife is like, oh, hey, kids, what don't, she's like, not quite Midwestern, but like something. But she's like also handles the whole thing really well. Like I wrote down in my notes, like this chick handles this situation so amazingly well. Like you should fucking buy her another goddamn ring for handling this so well. Cause like they comes out, oh, you're Gary's kids or whatever. They're like, oh, come on in. I'll make you egg salad sandwiches. And then she's like, oh, he's not here. Let me just give him a call. Have a seat on the couch with the plastic on it or whatever. So she's like, and it doesn't feel forced. It feels like she really is just kind of like, oh, okay, well, this is what we're doing today. Cool. I was planning on jazzercise, but I guess we'll do this instead. So she like gets them lemonade and then calls the dad like, hey, Earl, your daughters are here. Yeah. You want to come and buy and see them? Okay, well, he'll be right down. And she's like legit just kind of, all right, well, let's see how this plays out. And then like they're sitting on the couch awkwardly with like their little suitcases next to them. And then he comes in. And he's like the most stereotypical New York Jew, like walks in. It's just like, woof. I mean, I don't know if that was intentional or like they were telling him to like amp it up or something. But I am Jewish, so I feel free to say this. But like, it maybe it's because next to the wife, it was such a contrast because she was so like, gee golly, mister. And he was just like, hey, what are the girls doing here from New York? What is your mom? Does your mom know that you're here?
And apparently he's the only person who hasn't seen his ex-wife on television. Oh, your mom's a comedian? He's shocked by this. He's shocked by it. Everybody else in the world has seen her on HBO.
To be fair, they seem like the kind of family that like they don't pay the extra money for HBO. They're like, an extra $1.25 a month? Nah, they're not going to do that. That's fine. We'll watch it on cable.
Wow, that wasn't stereotypical at all.
Wait, what? Hey.
You said it, not me.
I didn't even mean it like that. I just...
Well, that's how it came across.
Well, fuck.
He starts making fun of her, and then the kids immediately jump to their mom's defense. It's like, well, where was this when your mom was in tears?
It's the lesson that we learned today. You appreciate the things when they don't go your way.
That's how the Carly Simon song went on the train ride home.
Yeah.
You miss your mom. I don't know why Carly Simon sounds like Bruce Springsteen. You miss your mom. He's basically like, I don't want you here. Here's $20. Get on the train. Go back home.
Well, like they get there. And then like, yeah, and the dad like walks in and then they have this kind of like brief scene where the new wife's like, hey, you know, Ernie, like your daughters came all the way to see you. Isn't that nice? Don't you want to like have them for lunch? And like, and they're kind of all looking at each other like, well, fuck, now what do we do? Like they didn't think it through once they got there. They had no idea like what happened.
They thought it was going to be, oh my God, you're here. Come on in. That's something what they like thought that, in their head.
Yeah. Like stay the night or like if you want to move in here, sure. Like
sure, we got an extra room.
Yeah.
You're welcome here.
So then like, oh, you know, I'll drive you to the train station. Eat your sandwiches first. But then, yeah, he drives him to the train station.
But so while all this is happening, we cut to Dan Aykroyd and Julie Kavner, who still really calm about this.
I mean, at this point, she's a bit more worked up, but still not as worked up as she should be.
And Dan Aykroyd is even calmer. Dan Aykroyd's like, hey, calm down. They're going to be okay.
I called all their friends. Call the babysitters. Should I call the police?
They're going to be back. I promise you they're going to be back. Sit tight. The phone is going to ring.
It's not ringing.
Come here and sit next to me. We'll wait.
I'm a terrible person.
I love you.
People love terrible people all the time.
It's true. Someone was married to Pol Pot.
Erica was right. I really didn't think about them.
I mean, I did think about them. In the beginning, I thought about them all the time. I spent 16 years doing nothing but thinking about them, and now I spend 3 months thinking about myself, and I feel like I murdered them.
You had to travel. It's part of your work. Look, kids are happy when their mother is happy.
No, they're not. Everyone says that, but it's not true. Kids are happy if you're there. You give kids a choice, your mother in the next room on the verge of suicide versus your mother in Hawaii in ecstasy, they choose suicide in the next room. Believe me.
And I think in the back of his head, it's like Dan Aykroyd is thinking, man, if these kids were out of the way.
It's like, hey, not my kids. It's not my problem.
But it's the typical, okay, there's a crisis, but I'm still going to make terrible jokes.
Yeah. And he's like still, and like, she's kind of pacing and like kind of sniffling into a tissue and he's eating a different tissue. And then it's like a weird thing where he starts talking about the movie, It's a Wonderful Life. He's like, you know the movie Wonderful Life? And she goes, yeah. And then he proceeds to then explain the movie Wonderful Life, but wrong. So it was like a weird thing. She's like, that's not what the movie's about at all. It's about family. And
all right. I'm going to be honest. At this point, I was sort of fast forwarding. It's like, okay.
Well, at this point, it's like the end of the movie. Like at this point, there's like 30 seconds.
Yeah. I'm like, okay, they're on the train. Let's go. All right. And the ex's wife phoned her. How she had her phone number is unclear because they were not able to get in touch with them for 10 years, but all of a sudden she knows her phone number.
I mean, I would assume, because this is also like the 90s where you would call like the operator, be like, hey, what's the number of like Dottie, whatever the fuck their last name is, in New York City? Like, I feel like either the girls.
Dottie,
like,
the comedian on HBO.
I almost said Dottie Henson, which is Gina Davis from A League of Their Own. Different Dottie. But like, I feel like either they had the number like buried at the bottom of a drawer, or like the girls left the number, or like she called the cousin of some. I'm kind of like, all right, she got the number. But I also thought it was really decent of the new wife to call Dottie and be like, hey, they were here. They're heading back home. They're okay. Nice to meet you, I guess. Like, you know, so that I think the best person in this movie is the new wife.
That the kids point that out.
100%. Like she and
I can't really picture. Well, they play her off as the wife is a bit
ditzy,
dippy, a bit stupid.
I mean, I wouldn't say she was stupid. I would say she was actually very cognizant of like the situation going on, but like simple. I'd say she's a little simple. Like, so not stupid.
It's hard to see those two together because she seems like a genuinely caring person and he seems like a selfish prick.
Yeah, that's the thing. I didn't like the two of them together. I'm like, how the hell did you guys get together? Because like, you don't deserve her. She's great. Like, she's like very kind of like, all right, well, you know, it's like a simple wife, whatever. But like, she's a good person.
And mom meets them at the train station.
Wearing a goddamn spacesuit.
They're immediately reunited because you know that train station, Grand Central Station, there's not a lot of people there. So two children are easy to find amongst a giant group of people.
To be fair, I think Erica's wearing like a giant flower hat because it was the 90s. And mom was wearing legitimately like a spacesuit jacket that's like the most brightest silver, like astronaut material. So like it would be very easy to spot each other in that crowd. But yes, they immediately find each other and they're like falling into each other crying. And then the Carly Simon song comes back up. You were the love of my life. I knew it since you were born. Like it's just this song that comes up throughout the movie periodically. And it's full, you know, swept up, full volume, you know, climactic moment. It's very, very emotional. Hooray. Everyone's back.
The scene ends with the three of them on the couch saying, you know what? I'm not going to travel as much. I am going to work. If something big comes up, we'll work it out.
And the girls are like, we'll be more supportive. We understand. Like we get it. We're on board now. So it's a compromise. We're all about compromise.
And then the movie just ends. It's like, okay, we made a compromise and it immediately cuts to a freeze frame and credits roll up. And that's
I appreciate the last two lines because like one of them, they're like talking about this. Oh, and they're like, well, you can do a show here in New York. You get your own TV show. And Todd is like, yeah, I could. Sure. We'll do that. We'll get a show. But then Erica's like, what about the moss? What are we going to do about the moss? And I do appreciate Todd. He goes, hey, he grows on you. And I'm like, I enjoyed that. But then she goes, what about the dots? And then it like Dottie gives her a look and then it just freeze frames. Then it's like the credits.
I've talked to comics who live in, you can make a living just by doing comedy in New York.
Sure.
And at this point, since she is super famous, I mean, she would have no problem getting booked. It's and this was a while ago, I'm sure, but a comic was like, you could play like 8 clubs a night. You could just, you do a club, hop in a cab, go to another club, get paid between $50 and $100 a show, 8 shows a night, nights a week.
That's a lot of shows.
Yeah, but no, it's not a full show. It's like you hop in, you do your guest set for 10, 15 minutes. You get $50 to $100 or however much it is. You go do that. You know, you can make $800 in one night. Let's just say $500, $2,500 a week. You know, roughly 10,000 if you're hustling and you're able to do it.
Yeah.
Now, according to the movie, she's in the position where she can do that.
Right.
Also, so here's the deal. Summer's out. They're not in school. They can go to California with her in the summertime because they're not in school.
They could. Like, we would have to assume that Erica's like either close to being 17 or close to being 18 at this point. And like, you know, she maybe mom's not gone for like 3 weeks at a time. And she's gone for like a long weekend or a week. Maybe Erica's okay to watch the younger sister at this point.
So, and once again, I'm going by my own people. I've talked to big name comics. I've worked with them and they're like, I work 2 weekends a month and they make good money and they're gone. You know, so they fly out on Friday. So basically they're gone 4 days out of the month making good money. And I guess they're trying to set up, well, she's new in the business. So she has to work that. I mean, so it's her rise to fame is totally unrealistic.
I feel like the path makes sense. The path is probably correct. It just happens way faster than it would in reality. Like in reality, that might take 5 years.
Yes, absolutely. If 4 to 5 years to get moving to New York. Yeah. If you're going to be a comic, live in New York, and the fact that if you don't have to work, you've got that money, take acting lessons.
Yeah.
Try to get commercials in New York. Something you can do during the day and do your comedy at night. So, but her rise to fame, and this entire movie takes place in 8 months, where she is a nobody in comedy to a headlining comic in Vegas doing television spots.
Right.
This all happens within 8 months.
I'm trying to think of like in the 90s, who were like the big female comedians at that time? And like the first two names that popped in my head are Paula Poundstone and Ellen DeGeneres.
Well, Roseanne was big then. Yeah. Roseanne Barr.
Whoopi probably.
Whoopi Goldberg. I mean, and then you still had, you know, you had your class, like Phyllis Diller was still around at that time. She was still doing comedy.
But she wasn't like new or like breaking onto the scene. Like, I feel like
she wasn't or you're talking about breaking onto the scene.
Yeah. Like kind of people that were like just coming in that were becoming like a big name around that time.
I still think they missed the huge opportunity, like showing the truth about a female comic.
I think that's an interesting concept. Yeah.
It's an interesting concept. Is she sleeping with her manager? Does she like her manager, or is she sleeping with him so she can headline the Tropicana?
Yeah.
What happens when they break up? Does her work dry up? With that line, she blows off the doorman. The doorman at a comedy club, she blows off. Now she can't get on the list.
Because, 100%, she says no to that guy, and he's absolutely not going to put her on the list. Like, that's just, I can just tell you that. Is that...
That, to me, that would have been a more interesting movie.
Yeah.
She just going right to the and I know this is supposed to be more, it's supposed to be more about a family drama.
Right.
I know that.
Yeah.
But I just can't get past all the comedy in it since that's my thing.
100% knew that when we went to talk about this, you were going to like rip the comedy aspect to shreds. I was waiting for that. But I also feel like they probably didn't realize at that time that the side thought of the movie about the how do women navigate the comedy scene is an interesting area to explore. I think that movie could be made now very easily, and it would be really interesting to watch. So let's go pitch that movie. Who do you know?
I was talking to a female comic, and she said something that didn't even occur to me being a male comic. She's like, if I'm driving and I have to, it's like if you were driving and you had to pull over to a rest stop and go to the bathroom and you're alone, you don't think anything of it. If I'm traveling alone and I'm in a rest stop alone, it's like it's little things like that where it's like I'm alone in this dark rest stop at night. What if something happens?
So here's I wasn't touring for comedy, but I was on a work trip in the before times and I was with my manager and we were renting a car, driving to a site to do an installation or whatever. And as we're getting into the car, he accidentally hits the panic button and the lights go off and the thing goes, meow, meow, and then he turns it off. And we're getting in the car. And he's like, oh man, that's so annoying. I wonder, like, why did they even put that on the key ring for the thing? And I look at him and I'm like, he's my manager, but we're also like sort of peers. So I'm like, I gotta say, your male privilege is showing. And he was like, what? And I said, that's on the key, the button, because like if I'm on this trip by myself and like something happens in this parking garage and I'm by myself, like that button might save my life. Like that is absolutely a thing that I'm aware of. Like if I'm in this parking garage without you at night, I'm looking around, I'm making sure that like no one's following me. I'm like looking in the backseat of the car. I've got my key in my hand. Like that's 100% the world that women live in. And like, and his eyes just kind of like widened. He was like, wow, yeah, I did not even think about that. And that's the truth. That's like the reality of the situation. Now that we've depressed everybody.
Yeah. We're going to sell that story to HBO.
HBO. It'll be on the air next week. I would watch that movie though. Like I 100%.
I would totally watch that movie. And I've never seen it. What's that show? The Amazing Miss Marple?
Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
I haven't seen it, but I hear that is a very good representation of a female in the stand-up community. Even though it's not set in modern times.
It is very much not set in modern times. Yeah. But I actually would be very curious as to your opinion of that. Because that I think is good stand-up, and that I think is a good portrayal of how your rise to comedy fame can work. Because it's not like a smushed timeline. Like things happen slowly in that series, and it's very good. And it's lots of deli.
I'm never going to watch this movie again.
Of course not. Of course not. Yeah.
And I can't recommend this movie. It fails on the comedy side. So you said I said it was like comfort food because you know what's going on. And you said there was a couple of things you didn't know was going to happen.
That I didn't know was going to happen. Or that I didn't remember. Cause I watched it like 20 years ago.
There was nothing new in this movie. This movie is standard ABC movie.
Well, I think also there's like the nostalgia factor because I did watch this movie a bunch when I was a kid. So there was
this
nostalgia.
This is my first time watching it. I've never seen it.
Well, of course. So you have no nostalgia attached to it. But also I was like a teenage girl growing up around that same time dealing with a mom, not like a single working mom or anything. And she's not a comedian, but like I've had those like struggles and those fights with my mom. So I also like could relate on that level. So I had like a little bit of more of a connection to the movie. Having said all that, yeah, this is not the kind of movie that it's like, oh, what am I going to watch, you know, that I want to watch for like the 15th time? Is it like Ghostbusters or Back to the Future or This Is My Life? Like, it's not on that list. Is it something that like every now and then maybe I'll throw in because I'm nostalgic? Maybe, because now apparently I own the DVD. Like, sure, it's more plausible that it could happen. But like, I wouldn't recommend it only because it's such a specific movie. Like, I can't imagine the mood someone needs to be in to watch it. Like if you're a mom daughter duo that's looking for like a movie to watch together after you go get your mani pedis and like have, you know, lunch at, you know, wherever you're gonna have your chicken salad sandwiches, sure, watch this with your daughter and bond a little bit. But like, I will say this, if it's a matter of picking between This Is My Life and Celtic Pride, you pick This Is My Life. This is a better movie by far than Celtic Pride.
Well, it's a better constructed movie, but it's just...
This movie is it's quieter, it's slower, but it's less painful. Celtic Pride was painful. Painful to watch. So is it a good movie? It's not a bad movie. Like, I wouldn't say it's bad, but I wouldn't say it's good. I will say it's better than Celtic Pride.
It's a competent movie. I will say that. It's a competent movie.
It is a movie. It is a movie.
It's
a movie. I feel like the cast had no right to be as good as it was for this movie. Like, I don't know.
I am surprised because Nora Ephron and all these people in this movie know that's not how comedy works. So I'm surprised that they would put that on film because they know that's not how comedy. They know that's not how show business works.
Maybe that's
There's no such thing as an overnight success. If it was an overnight success where she did something that got her attention, and she got really big quick and then faded really quick. Cause that's what happens with overnight successes, but mm-hmm. it's just, just unrealistic. All right. So before we sign off, Emmy, what do you want to promote?
Okay. Well, if you're in the Boston area, come see my sketch group, Suzzy. We're performing at the Rossi Square Theater on March 18th. If you're in the Boston area and you want to see some comedy sports, which is short form improv, we have matches March 12th and March 19th. And if you're not in the Boston area, go see comedy sports in a different city because they exist in other places as well.
Well, that's it. This has been another episode of the Dan Aykroyd Podcast. I want to thank my guest, Emmy, for doing this for me. Actually, I don't want to thank you. Fuck you. Fuck you.
Hey.
And we are out of here. We'll see you next time. Bye. Why did you salute? This is a podcast.
I was trying not to step on your goodbye. So I was doing a silent, like, I acknowledge that we're done.
Why would you be silent in a podcast?
Because you're the host. I didn't want to step on your closing. I'm trying. Should I be less polite? Is that what you're telling me? Be less polite.
Well, you just stepped on my closing.
Okay, do it again. No, do yourself.
No, I'm not going to do it again.
Should I keep recording or we're done? Should I stop recording?
You can stop now.
I can stop now. Okay, I wasn't sure.
To support this podcast, please go to www.patreon.com/ScottWhite and give what you're able. If you're listening on iTunes, please give a review. That should help people find this podcast. And no matter what services you use to listen, please leave feedback. We always want to improve. Thank you for listening to the Dan Aykroyd Podcast.
I don't know how to explain what happened to me. It was like I was shot into orbit. The air was thinner. I lost my mind. And you know, I wish more than anything that someday the same thing happens to you. Only, I hope it happens before you have children. Afterwards, it's complicated. It's very complicated. I was away too much. I'm not going to be away so much anymore, okay?
Okay. Promise?
Yes. Yes, I do.
But if something great comes up?
I'll do it. We'll work it out. Somehow we're going to work this out.
How?
I have no idea.
Couldn't you do a TV show? Then you could stay at home.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
No, really, I mean it.
Well, it's possible.
It could be about a woman who works at a makeup counter in Queens.
Yeah, absolutely. A single mother and her two kids. Only they're not you.
Absolutely not.
Right. I mean, they don't even have to be girls. They could be boys.
Boys?
Oh, we don't want to be boys.
No? All right, well, then they're girls. They're girls. You can pick their names. What do you want to be called?
Felice.
Are you serious?
Okay, Chenille.
Chenille. Oh, great. I have a younger daughter named Chenille.
Veronica.
Oh, sweetheart. That's who you are.
What about the moss?
Maybe you'll get to like the moss. He grows on you.
What about the dots?
You can drive me crazy.
Has been a Cross the Streams Media Podcast.
You ever see It's a Wonderful Life?
Sure.
It's about this guy who has dreams. He wants to travel. He wants to build bridges. But in the end, we're supposed to believe that he's better off because he never did any of it? Well, that's all crap. It's crap.
I love that movie.
No, it's total crap.
That's not what that movie is saying. It's saying if a person stays home, they can make an enormous difference in the people's lives who are near to them. If it weren't for Jimmy Stewart, his brother would have died. The pharmacist would have gone to jail. His children. He never ever would have had his children. His children never would have been born.
porn.
What pharmacist?
There's a pharmacist.
I don't remember any pharmacist.